Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett. James has been on the program a number of times. He appears almost every week for, I'm not sure, several months, 6 months, more. James, how long have you been appearing on the program?
It's got to be at least 6 months by now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it probably is. You were off for 2 months or 2 weeks while you went to Europe. You were invited to speak in the Netherlands, if I understand correctly, on a you delivered a speech on Central Asian, Eurasian politics. I noticed in the introduction, I saw the video of the presentation, you were described as a one-man intelligence agency. I'd say that's pretty flattering, and I'm sure that should have pleased. I doubt that you would dispute that. You should have been pleased by that description. In your speech, you described a complex web of spies and terrorists working for or against United States interests and attempts to influence and control Central Asia. And I'm curious if you believe, you describe where there are a host of languages and nationalities and cultures in the area. Is there really a complex web of spies and terrorists, or is this just incoherence and chaos that are natural in a region where you see so many languages and cultures and races and so on?
Well,
organized,
yeah.
But complex web or chaos? What are we looking at?
Well, once again, I'd say, does it have to be one or the other? Can it not be a mixture of both? And in fact, I think that's kind of part of the point that I was attempting to make in the speech, is that this the chaos that you describe and the division and conflict that already exists in the region is being exacerbated by various programs that are taking place there. And I think these programs take advantage of the fact that this is such a linguistically and ethnically and culturally and religiously diverse area, which makes it easier to drive that wedge in and to split open things that already exist. And I think we've seen this happen before in many different parts of the globe in many different historical eras. But I mean, we just have to look at the Middle East and the types of, you know, religious division that goes on there that can again be exploited for various political purposes, like what's happening in Syria right now. So I think it's not a particularly new idea or something that we haven't seen before. I think it just is not really receiving much of a spotlight right now because Central Asia is just not on the radar of the media and of most of the public. But it is absolutely an extremely important part of the globe and only becoming more important, I think, in this era in which we see the kind of battle lines being drawn between NATO and Russia and China and Iran and Turkey and some of the other players that are looking at this Central Asia Caucasus region. So I was hoping to try to paint that picture for people in this presentation and, of course, relate it back to a very, very interesting interview series I conducted last year with FBI whistleblower Sibel Edmonds.
All right. This multicultural contest for dominance in Central Asia was based on a premise that was advanced almost a century ago by one of the world's first geopolitical analysts. And his argument was that controlling Central Eurasia was the key to controlling the world. Do you believe that premise is valid? We've got all these people that are pushing and pulling, and they're trying to gain advantage, keep somebody else from getting advantage, try to gain advantage for themselves, suppress the other. Is control of Central Eurasia really critical, or are we simply playing the great game? That was the way you described it in part, and I believe that was probably a term the British used when they struggled with Russia to control Central Eurasia. Are we just picking up on the game? Does anyone really know what's going on here? Are we doing this out of habit? Or is the premise correct that this is critical to controlling the world?
Well, I think this is related to the great game. As you say, this was a British term that was used in the 19th century to describe Russian and British struggle over the Central Asia region that is the focus of this presentation. And that was basically a surrounding Britain's fear of losing the crown jewel of the British Empire at the time, India, to the Russians, who were getting something of a toehold, and they wanted to make sure they didn't get Afghanistan because that would have been a domino that would have led towards India. So that was very much part of the struggle in the 19th century. And now here we are in the 21st century, and this same area is still very much in contest and involves, in fact, the same well, I mean, historically linked powers. I mean, I think at this point you could say that the NATO allied powers are pretty much an extension of the old British Empire. It's the Anglo-American Empire in some ways. And they're, of course, occupying Afghanistan as part of an important part, toehold into that region, just like in the 19th century. So so there are some obvious historical parallels there. And as you say, it was Sir Halford John Mackinder, PC, Privy Council, who came up with the formulation of why this was so important in the Great Game, why this was seen as such an important region. That formulation came in 1904 in an essay that he wrote that's usually considered to be the founding document of geopolitics, and then further articulated in a 1919 work that he did, in which he had this little phrase that's oft repeated: who rules East Europe commands the heartland, who rules the heartland commands the world island, who rules the world island commands the world. And this goes back to his idea that you could divide the world into these inherently isolated geographical regions, and the world island was kind of the Eurasian mega supercontinent, and then the heartland is basically this Central Asian Caucasus region. And he had a number of different reasons for proposing this that had to do with supply routes and things that were exploitable at that time. There were a lot of people who came along after Mackinder and said, well, you know, this is now the age of the airplane, and this is going to change the game, and so this isn't such a strategically valuable region. But it turns out that that didn't actually change the game so much. There still does need to be an actual boots-on-the-ground presence and actual supply lines for a military to command a presence of any given theater. And this region is, once again, I mean, as it has historically been, is an extremely important crossroads between Asia and Europe, and continues to serve that function. So it continues to be a very, very important square on the chessboard. And that was articulated again just a decade ago almost 2 decades ago now, by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who basically reiterated Mackinder's heartland theory. He came up with this idea of the Eurasian Balkans, but basically he's talking about the same heartland that Mackinder was talking about, and saying that anyone who wants to control the world needs to control this Eurasian Balkans region that he identified, which is the exact same region. It's the Central Asia Caucasus region, and it still continues to be an important part. And I think that's exactly why we saw the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. I think that's the deeper underlying geopolitical motive for that, rather than just trying to get rid of, you know, Al Qaeda. I think there was a much deeper geopolitical reason for that, and that's why the U.S. is not really going to leave Afghanistan. They're going to start pulling out some of their formal troops, but they're going to maintain their tens of thousands of contractors, just like in Iraq, and they're going to be involved in that region for a very long time to come, because it is still geostrategically quite important. I think the only question really is whether or not it's going to be a hard power domination of this area or a soft power domination, and to what extent secret operations like the NATO Gladio program will be used to try to destabilize and control the region in various ways.
Do you think Afghanistan can be controlled by any mechanism, hard or otherwise? It's been attempted for centuries, and nobody can get a handle. It's the country comes off, the appearance of the country is that of a bunch of fragmented rocks kind of piled up and here, there, or wherever. Seems to have no value whatsoever, and yet, what, Rome? I don't recall who was the first one. Was it Rome or was it Alexander? Alexander, perhaps, who lost his military momentum in Afghanistan. I don't remember if it was him or Rome. But the British, they went in there and they thought they could handle it. They couldn't. The Russians went in and they thought they could handle it and they couldn't. It makes you wonder. It's certainly strange. We aren't going to take those people by force, I don't think. You could maybe kill them all, and then maybe you got a chance at controlling that country. But otherwise, can we?
That's the big question, isn't it? And of course, you're referring to this idea of Afghanistan Graveyard of Empires, which is actually a name, or the name of an article that was written by Milton Bearden back in November, December 2001 in the Council on Foreign Relations publication, Foreign Affairs. And I hope people understand the significance of the Council on Foreign Relations publication Foreign Affairs, but also Milton Bearden is an interesting figure. He was a CIA, I believe a station chief in Afghanistan, in Pakistan from 1986 to 1989, who was obviously intimately involved in CIA involvement in Afghanistan during that period when they were fighting against the Ruskies and using, of course, the Mujahideen. So he plays an interesting part in the sort of the story of Osama bin Laden and the CIA support of it. But anyway, he wrote about this back in November, December 2001, talking about the dangers of becoming involved in this area. And you're right, it was Alexander the Great sent his supply trains through the Khyber, then skirted northward with his army to Konar Valley on his campaign in 327 BC. And then he was struck by an Afghan archer's arrow and calamity ensued. So the idea of Afghanistan as a graveyard of empires is one that's been around for a long time, and it's been fleshed out through multiple centuries of experience. But the question, can it actually be dominated in the current day and age? I think, to be honest, I don't think it's necessarily a question of being militarily dominant in the country. I think it's more one to do with whether or not the political situation can be more or less controlled. I mean, all that the U.S., I think, really needs is to have the bases there, to have the ability to use Afghanistan as a staging point for other operations. And, of course, I mean, there are certain intrinsic values to the Afghanistan itself, including the mineral deposits that are there. It's been called the Saudi Arabia of lithium and other things. Apparently, $1 trillion supply of lithium in the country, and other intrinsic reasons for that. It's also, of course, important as a potential supply route for pipelines transits. But I think that ultimately, in regards to its relation to Central Asia, it is more of the sort of the toehold idea that it's just used as a way to project power into that region generally. And I think that can be done without necessarily conquering Afghanistan in any outright sense, which is why
these people take bribes.
Do you think?
They want to live in mud huts, for God's sake, and fight and die. I don't know how you can't. How do you influence these people?
Well, actually, I mean, it's funny that you say that, because of course we did find out, I believe it was last year or earlier this year, at any rate, there was extensive reporting on the shopping bags full of cash that that old President Karzai used to take from the CIA that was admitted and reported on by Time magazine and others. So that was absolutely one way that they had control over their puppet, Karzai, who, of course, was a former UNOCAL representative. So I think perhaps he was already inclined
on the street shooting with a Kalashnikov at American soldiers. I mean, the people that actually do the fighting, I'm sure they can be bribed to some degree and the rest of that. But there's something that you just can't seem to really move these people.
Right. I think you're never going to win the hearts.
These are my rocks, and I'm not giving them up to anybody else. I don't know.
I agree. You're never going to win the hearts and minds of a lot of the people in Afghanistan. But again, I don't think that's necessarily what counts here. I don't think it's a full domination of the country that's necessary. I think it's just the ability to use it as a staging point, the ability to allow Western corporations in, perhaps, to extract some of the mineral wealth. I'm sure that will be part of what's going on there. But I see this as more of a ability to project power into Central Asia. And I think Afghanistan is more of a staging point for that than something that's inherently valuable in and of itself.
Now, the British were concerned that Afghanistan would be, you said, perhaps a domino. There was perhaps something like a domino theory going on. And they were concerned that it would be used by Russia to capture the crown jewel of the English Empire, which was India. But right now you're describing Afghanistan as an avenue not to head south into India, but to head north into Eurasia. Am I understanding correctly?
Right. I think that would, I think the domino might fall in the other direction this time.
You know, I look at this and we talk about domino theory, and I recall Vietnam because I was drafted during that era. I didn't actually go to Vietnam myself, but it was justified. We had a domino theory. And if we didn't stop them in Vietnam, they would soon be in Rockford, Illinois, or wherever. Are all of our domino theories real, or are they just the creation of people who like to scare us into obedience.
Well, the interesting thing about geopolitical theorizing is that it has a way of becoming reality. It can be a self-fulfilling prophecy in a lot of ways. So that, for example, when Mackinder highlights this section of the globe, and then Brzezinski furthers that towards the end of the 20th century, whether or not there is actual sense to what they're saying, it doesn't really matter as long as what they are saying influences actual policy, because then it becomes what they're talking about. So I think there is something inherently to this idea. I think there is the Central Asia region is important, and for a number of different reasons. I mean, not only because it's right on Russia's doorstep, it has the historical links to the Soviet, the old Soviet Union. Of course, these Central Asian republics used to be part of the Soviet Union, so they're somewhat in the Russian diplomatic orbit, but so wresting them out of that control could be extremely important as part of a NATO encirclement strategy. It's also extremely important, as I say, as a supply line for not only the historical Silk Road, which goes back to the Han Dynasty thousands of years ago, but now is explicitly being attempted to be reconstructed by Xi Jinping as part of the new Silk Road, which they're trying to get
from
off the
China
ground.
From China to Russia?
From China to Turkey. And elsewhere. The new Silk Road is not just going to be sort of China's outlet to Europe, ultimately. It's going to be a number of different ways. They have a maritime branch of this Silk Road idea and other such things. It's basically China's doorway to the world at this point. And Central Asia.
When I wonder if the world just fights for the sake, is there something about our species that we just need to fight and we're not too particular about what the reason is? We'll talk about maybe the answer to that question when we return in a moment. We're going to take a break for some commercials. Be right back. I'm Alfred Addisk with James Corbett on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk here on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett, who is the author behind the Corbett Report at CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. You can check out, just Google Corbett Report. You'll get to it. We've been talking about a speech that James presented in Netherlands last 2 weeks, dealing with Central Eurasian politics. And when we closed off this last segment to take some commercials, I was wondering, is there something about the human species where we are just bound and determined to fight, even if there's not a shortage of resources, even if there's enough food, you know, wild women, plenty of alcohol? Is there still something that compels us to fight?
In a word, yes. I think that, well, there's a lot of different things that go into this. And you can, of course, take a look at, I think, human psychology, which will probably tell us that there is a certain percentage of human beings who do have some sort of just desire for bloodshed or what have you. And I think the argument would be, well, it's better if we put them in a uniform and train them up and sent them to fight in some sort of war than to just leave them on the streets. I mean, I'm sure that's a type of argument that's been forwarded for a very long time. I would say that there's something more important to that discussion, though, which is the fact that whatever the cause for this bloodlust, it is politically and economically and in many other ways useful to an oligarchical control grid. I think this is part of what I was articulating in that speech. It's known as the strategy of tension, and it's more of a psychological manipulation tactic than anything else. It's the idea of creating chaos, creating havoc, creating the conditions for bloodshed and hostilities as a way of basically terrorizing a population. I mean, terror in the true sense of that word as a political tool, terrorizing a population into doing things and to allowing things that otherwise wouldn't. And warfare has, throughout history, I think, been used more or less explicitly for that purpose. And we can look very specifically at the wars of the last century. I mean, obviously, the Great War, the war to end all wars, World War One, which had a lot of flowery, you know, democracy type rhetoric strewn around it. And what did it leave in its wake? It left the aspiration of the League of Nations, at least the idea that there could be some sort of global body that could protect us from those types of wars in the future. And of course, that was a pipe dream, but it was a seed that was planted and of course came somewhat more to fruition after the wake of the Second World War in the United Nations. And I think that these types of great, spectacular bloodshed events can be used to shape society and is used for that purpose. And that's why I think when we look at things like what's going on in Central Asia and Caucasus, where we seemingly just see all of these scattered sort of terror attacks and events and Islamic radicalism, and it just seems all scattered and chaotic, that can be part of an orderly plan, which is to create the chaos in order to justify X, Y, and Z. I'm sorry, X, Y, and Z for my American friends. So I mean, it sounds complex, but I think at base it's actually quite simple. It's about terrorizing populations.
It's fundamental and simple. The application is fairly complex. I mean, that's perhaps the application of what you're saying. One of the things that crosses my mind as we talk about this is that during the battle at Gettysburg in the American Civil War, it's my understanding that people traveled to the site of the battle. Civilians traveled, they brought a picnic lunch, and they planned to just sit up on the hill and watch the battle. It was like going to the Super Bowl or something like that. And I've heard the same thing is true at Waterloo when the British met Napoleon. People from the surrounding communities came up and they just sat on the side of the battlefield, and they watched the armies clash and do whatever they were going to do, but the people themselves did not feel particularly threatened. And the reason that's interesting to me is today, I don't think we had terrorism back then. We had armies that met head to head, and they were the only ones that got shot and killed and whatever, by and large. You know, I mean, when the Huns invaded or whatever, but I'm talking about Western armies, they just fought head on. Terrorism seems to be more directed at the civilian population. It's not about head-to-head fighting with another organized military force. It's about putting people in a community, in a nation, in a state of fear. And not the fighters, not the warriors, not the military, to inspire that state of fear and then exploit that state of fear. That seem true to you?
That I think touches on something very, very fundamental that's going on. I think the only thing that I would differ with in what you said there is that certainly there was that sense of more of almost, I guess you could say, almost more of a spectator sport back in the day, the mm-hmm. types of battles that went on, because as you say, it was armies meeting in prescribed battles on the battlefield, and there were certain rules of warfare at that time that were generally observed in Europe, and so it would have been safe and also technologically safe, because the instruments of battle were not quite as advanced as they are today for people to watch from a distance, or at any rate, the civilian populations didn't have to feel so threatened by that. However, I would say that, I mean, armies have always throughout history raped, looted, and plundered areas. So, I mean, I think we should...
That was usually before or after the battle.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't part of the fighting per se, but part of the spoils of war.
Everybody should be safe while they were having the battle.
Right.
It was afterwards, that's when you better hide out.
Right, but leaving that aside for the moment, but I think what you're touching on is something very important, because it used to be that the real, I mean, battle and fear and bloodshed and all of that was generally between the combatants on the battlefield. And now it's almost the exact opposite. When you have these people sitting in literally playing with joystick controllers, piloting drones from thousands of miles away from the safety of the area of their home in the United States, and they're piloting drones over Yemen or Pakistan or wherever, It's almost the exact opposite. Now the combatants are actually the spectators of this, and it's really the civilian populations and the populations that are being targeted, which generally are civilians, who are called enemy combatants, although apparently that has just changed as a part of official Department of Defense doublespeak dictionary has just been changed. But these enemy combatants, these civilian populations, are the ones that are terrorized by the fighting. So it is almost an exact inverse of what used to take place. I'm not saying that either way is particularly better. I mean, I think they're both lamentable in their own way, but it is an interesting inversion, and I think that is part of the what we're talking about, the idea that this is now part of a psychological strategy of trying to manipulate populations into going along with various political strategies.
Well, we had Sun Tzu, The Art of War, and one of his principles where you attack the enemy where he's weakest. And that would certainly be the unarmed, poorly armed, poorly organized civilians. They'd be the weakest link in the total war-making machine. In Vietnam, I know that the MOS that's the job descriptions that suffered the most casualties in Vietnam, they were clerks. People who ran typewriters, they were the ones most likely to die in Vietnam. The Vietnamese didn't want to fight with the American military. They knew that the army runs on its typewriters, and they would attack facilities, snipe, whatever, try to knock out the clerks. So it's another one of these situations where, to some degree, maybe the military is safer. And it's the people who are unarmed and non-combatants. They are now more targets, consistent with Sun Tzu and General Giap, and who knows. So before we finish up here, we've got probably a little over 5 minutes left, right about 5 minutes left. We interviewed Greg Hunter earlier today. And Greg Hunter, we talked to him about his recent interview with Rob Kirby of Kirby Analytics, who reportedly makes his money by brokering the sale of large masses of gold, tons of gold. He doesn't sell $20 gold pieces or 1 ounce gold coins and rest of that. That's not what Rob Kirby helps to broker, the sale of tons of gold from people who want to buy tons from people who want to sell tons of gold. And he's got to be dealing with some very rich, intelligent, knowledgeable people just because of the mass of money that's there. There's a good indication these people know what they're doing. While he was interviewed by Greg Hunter, he claimed that right now in Asia, not around the world, but in Asia, there are people who are buying tons of gold and they are paying a premium of at least 50% over spot to acquire the gold. In other words, when gold is selling for $1,200 an ounce right here among myself and retailers and so on, it's $1,200 an ounce plus whatever premium is attached for being a collectible, yada, yada. These people in Asia are buying tons of gold and they are paying the equivalent of $1,800 at least per ounce of their tons of gold. Is this something you've heard about? Does this sound credible to you? And if so, what do you make of it?
Well, that is interesting. This is not something that I can directly confirm, but it is in keeping in line with the news that has been coming out of Asia, specifically East Asia, mainly China, over the last several years of increased buying, increased frenzy over gold, and people putting a premium on physical gold. So I think it's in keeping with the trends that we know have been happening, although there has been some ado made about the fact that there's been a slowdown in the Chinese gold market over the past year and off from the blistering record pace of sales last year. But, I mean, it certainly sounds like it could very much be real. I can't say with any certainty that this is a phenomenon, but we do know that there has been some very interesting maneuvers going on at the central banking level with regards to gold recently. Of course, there was that Swiss referendum, which just failed to protect the Swiss franc by mandating a 20% gold reserve. That's interesting. At the same time that campaign for the Save Our Gold initiative in Switzerland was taking place, the Netherlands, surprisingly to everyone, repatriated some of its gold from I believe from the New York Fed. They repatriated something like 100 tons of gold, which was a surprise to everyone because I don't think anyone knew that that was happening. And of course, we have the German gold situation continuing as it has for the last couple of years. And now France and others are starting to agitate for potentially trying to repatriate their gold. So again, I mean, this is part of a worldwide phenomenon, I think, of understanding that physical gold possession is more important than pieces of paper that say you have gold. And so again, this if what Rob Kirby is saying is true, it certainly does play into a larger trend that we've seen developing for years now. And it wouldn't surprise me in the least. In fact, it makes every economic sense, I think, in this age of massive wholesale manipulation of anything that that is on paper is being manipulated at this moment in the Wall Street universe. So I certainly understand why people would pay such a premium on gold.
It implies to me that they anticipate there's going to be a dramatic change of some sort in the very near future. I don't believe anyone is paying a 50% premium on gold because they think the price of gold is going to rise to $1,800 or $2,000 an ounce 3 years from now. They're doing this because they think something's going to happen in the near future, very near future. Let me want one last question. We've got maybe 50 seconds, 45 before we have to break loose. You talk about foreign countries trying to repatriate their gold. What are the chances that the United States is going to discover that our government has sold off our gold out of our treasury and perhaps we no longer have 8,200 tons? We may only have a few hundred tons left. Do you think those stories are real, credible, unlikely? What do you think?
Well, if we have 30 seconds to cover it, I would say that I would be surprised if there really is that 8,200 tons, and I don't believe it till I see it. Call me a curmudgeon, but that's the way I look at it, and there has to be a reason why the Fed has been dragging its feet on repatriating the German gold, and I don't think that's reason is because they have so much gold sitting in their vaults, and they're happy to give the German gold back. I mean, where there's smoke, there's fire, and I think in this case, there must be a lot of missing gold, or gold that's been leased to multiple people and that type of thing. A lot of shenanigans that's gone on in the back door for a long time. And that's exactly why this repatriation movement is taking off in so many different countries right now.
All right, James, thanks very much for being on the program. I always enjoy talking to you. I hope you had a good time in Europe. And I hope things are comfortable in Japan right now. And I want to thank all you folks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Melody. And in the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Frank, and James from the Corbett Report. All right.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay.